Our main speaker tonight is Gordon.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Gordon. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank everyone who did service here tonight. It's very important that we all do service here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for a group of people who said to me one day, thank you for being a service. And it meant so much to me because I thought all of you were hated me and wanted to just abuse me. I went to a meeting on Staten Island when I was new, and it was me and this other guy, Fernando. And we walked in. It was a bunch of iron workers there and retired cops and firefighters. And we came down the stairs and, you know, walked in the meeting full of ourselves. And one of these guys came up to us and said, you guys ready to do the steps? And we're like, yeah, we're ready to do the steps. And they were like, well, there's a dustpan, there's a broom, go sweep the steps. So we did, and me and Fernando, we just cursed these guys out. We're angry. And the following week, we came to the meeting again, and the guys said, you know, you guys ready to do the steps? And they were like, yeah, well, there's the dustpan and broom. Go do the steps. Third week, I wasn't going to have it. I just grabbed a dustpan and a broom and just did the steps. But someone came down the stairs and said, thank you for being a service. It means so much to be doing a group. So whenever I share from the floor, I always have to remind myself, thank you for being a service, because it saved my life. And it's very important. At that same group, a couple months later, they needed a coffee maker. And they said, you're making coffee with this guy, Charlie. And I was like, well, don't I have a say in the matter? And they were like, no. And so I started doing coffee with Charlie, and it started to get hot. And this was the summer of 90. It was the hottest summer on record. And me and Charlie started, you know, making coffee every week. And then one day, it was just very, very, very hot. And we decided, we had this brilliant idea. We were going to put iced tea and lemonade in the coffee urns, and we were going to get the Oreo cookies or the Chip Ahoy's. So we cut up a watermelon and got fruit, and we put it out, and we thought we were so proud of ourselves. And then the meeting of people came in, and all we heard was, where in the blank is the coffee? Where in the blank is all the, where are the cookies? Where is this? And, you know, we hated these people because all they did was went to the coffee, and they poured it, you know, they stirred it up, they took a sip, and they made this face like, ugh. And so then they mess up the display of cookies and things like that. And, you know, every week it was the same thing. And they never called us by our names. They always said this other word, which I will not repeat. And finally, when the week we did that, everyone was like, who did this? Well, the following week, we knew it didn't matter how hot it was. You make coffee for an AA meeting, and you get cookies for the drunks. But one thing that did that week was everyone knew my name, and that's when the isolation stopped. You know, everyone knew me at that group. And it continues because I need to be of service, and it's very important. This group is amazing, all the service commitments, and people show up and do them. I know in my home group we have a lot of service positions, and I could tell you a couple of home groups I've been a member of that are not around anymore because people forgot to what it was like to give it away for free. I could just name 14th Street Workshop. I was a member of that group for years, and people forgot. And luckily, there was a meeting that spun off because a couple people wanted to keep the meeting going. It was a beginner's meeting at 10:30 in the morning. And we, when 14th Street went to 12th Street, they closed that meeting for in favor of another group. So a couple of us got together, and we wanted to keep this beginner's meeting going. And it was the only beginner's meeting below 96th Street on Saturday morning. And it was 24 of us about 16 and a half years ago. And now that meeting is two meetings with about 250, 300 people every Saturday. I'm a member of the Saturday Beginners Big Book group. I've been sober since April 18th, 1990. I do service at that home group. I do service outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm proud to do it. I can't always do it, but I try to do it as much as I can. I do service there. I am sponsored by someone. I won't tell you his name because his ego's too big. I sponsor eight guys because my ego's too big, and they always call me when I don't want to be bothered. And I've done the steps, and I read with guys one-on-one or in groups once a week because I need to read the literature. And also, I go to a lot of literature-based meetings, like Saturday Beginners, literature-based Sunday morning meditation, where we focus on the 11th step. And I go to Citigroup and some other meetings because I still go to 4 to 5 meetings a week, even after 25 years of continuous sobriety. And it's important to do those things because it's so easy to forget. I still have that ism, that incredibly short memory. And I have to always stay plugged in, always plugged in. I do a written 10-step every single day because it works. just like alcohol did at one point. But the 10th step, when I put pen to paper or just text it on my phone and just write it, it takes away some of that power. I practice prayer and meditation where I sit quietly and I dedicate time to God, usually sometimes 10 minutes in the morning and usually 10 minutes at night. And I have the two amazing, or I have, now I have one passed away, two amazing meditation teachers. And they're two cats I adopted from the Humane Society 18 years ago. Because whenever I want to go sit on my computer and just look at the internet and see what you're doing on Facebook, one of them will walk right in front of the keyboard and in front of the monitor and sit in my lap, and he'll just sit down and get quiet, have his mantra to purr, and he just wants to be petted and be quiet and be still. And I just sit there and I listen to him. There's no timer. He'll tell me when he's done. And I'll sit there. And the same thing today. We had to put down my wife. I wanted to wish my wife a happy anniversary today, her anniversary. She couldn't be here. We split up AA meetings. I have zone 3, which is downtown. She has zone 7, and we split 5. I get the morning meetings. She has the nighttime meetings. And this was her meeting, so that's one reason why I couldn't come. But we had adopted another cat today, and we went to the Humane Society, brought it home. And here we have an 18-year-old cat, which reminded me of me, a crusty old-timer who doesn't like anything new, and with a new cat. And I saw me in that cat, and I saw the new cat who wanted to explore everything, who wants to change the steps, who wants to change everything, you know? And this other cat just wants to be friendly and do things. And I also have two parrots, two macaws. I've had them for, 18 years. And one of them been trying to teach easy does it for the last 18 years. And he just gets easy out. But they're very disciplined, loving pets. And those are the things that are in my life today. My life today was just like, I turned the phone off. I didn't want to hear from work because I work in the news industry. And I get called away at a moment's notice. They're like, can you go do this? Can you go photograph this? Can you go do this? And today was like, no. I promised Naya I would be here, and I want to thank you for asking me to come. And I told people I was going to come here. A couple of them came, and here I am. And I'm grateful to be sober today. And, just what my life is like today, it's amazing. And as I say, I'm in 10, 11, and 12. And in that 12th step, it's not what I so much what I could do and say up here what I do. It's what I do when I show up for work. And I treat people the way I want to be treated. I go to work for God, not for man. I don't expect anything in return. I treat people the way I want to be treated. And if I get a paycheck, wonderful. But also on my 10th step, I write down 3 kind acts I do every single day. And they're not for me. They're for the other person and for God. And I don't tell no one about it. Tom H., who all of you know, I remember I had to do an exercise years ago that the late Bob Bilheimer taught me, who was my sponsor for 15 years. He made me write a list of 10 people who I wanted what they had. And I did, and I wrote down what it was about their sobriety I liked. And whenever I sponsor a guy and I take him to that exercise, I do it too. And when we asked Tom H. a couple years ago, like I was approaching over 20 years, and I was like, Tom, I admire this about you, how you show up here, you do service, you're always vocal, and you're dedicated to AA, and you live AA. What do you do to be the way you are? And he just said to me, the longer you stay sober, the more you do without people noticing. And it was like very hard because my ego wants that attention. I want everyone to know what I'm doing. But now it's just like cut that down and just be where we are. Stay out of your own way and just take me out of the equation and just be just a loving person, just one of these people walking among your fellows. I grew up on Staten Island. My mother was Dutch Protestant. My father was Irish Catholic, strike 1, strike 2, Staten Island, strike 3. my home movies were shot in a bar. Most people have their home movies were shot at Disneyland or the amusement park or the beach. Mine was shot at, the Seahorse and the Kennedy's Bar and Grill. It looks like an episode of Shameless without audio. It was all done at Super 8. And everything is yellow and decaying, and it's horrible to watch. There are scenes out where I'm not eating even in the bar. My parents are in the bar. I'm playing outside, and instead of going outside to film us, my parents just opened the window and stuck the camera out. And there's one scene where you see the the alcoholics' tiles, the ceiling tiles. You know, the ones that you always see in the hospitals or institutions that we all know about with the fluorescent lights, because that's all you see in the camera. It looked like someone took a swig of a beer and, you know, held the camera like this. But that's where I grew up, in a bar. I love bars. I love the smell of bars. I love the atmosphere of bars. I love the crying of beer music that you hear in bars. Everything about it. The Stewart sandwiches, the beer nuts, the goldfish that they put on the bar. And I love the lighting of a bar. Some of you might remember the Subway Inn when it was over here. When I used to come to this meeting on Tuesday, we used to walk by there in the summer, and the door was open, and you smell that exhaust come out. A stale beer and urine and disinfectants, and it was like, you know, it was like, could I buy that in Bloomingdale's? You know, like Calvin Klein hangover, you want to remember it. But that was the attraction. And I remember as a kid, you know, people giving me money, people buying me sodas, and people taught me how to play pool and pinball. And I remember once watching guys playing pool and getting too close, and I got hit with a cue stick above the eye. And I started crying and bawling. And then people were, like, coming over and, like, oh, you feel bad. And then John the bartender. How many has a John the bartenders in their story? Well, this John the bartender came over and said, I got you an orange Nidic soda. I was 6 years old. And I put a special surprise in it for you. And what he did was he doused it with rum because he wanted me to shut up. And then what I did was I drank that Nidic soda, and I knew there was something different about it. I like how it made me feel. So anytime I went to the Seahorse, I was always crying my eyes out. I was falling down trying to get something to get that drink. And as I saw the alcoholism and what happened in my own family, both my parents, how their alcoholism just grew and grew and grew. My mother did the Irish divorce. My father came home drunk one night with a lot of money. She went through his pockets, and she ran off with the kids to another state, the Irish divorce. And we went to California, and she remarried, met another man who was an alcoholic. I hated this guy. This guy hated me. But my ism was in full effect. I was full of anger, rage, resentment, and all I wanted to do was kill this man because suddenly I was big enough where he couldn't touch me anymore. And one day he tried to put his hands on me, and then the police came. And instead of taking him away, the cops took me away. And they took me to a neighbor's house. I was 14 years old. I was about 6'2", 180 pounds. And the neighbors put me up for a couple days. And then one day, then my mother called, and I thought she was going to say, he's leaving, and said she met me at a street corner, handed me $100 and told me, go. I don't want anything to do. Tell me where you want. You go. I'll send your stuff. And what I heard was I was a useless piece of garbage and no one wanted me. And I went back to these people's house just like shell-shocked. And I was like saying goodbye, thank you. And they looked at me in horror. And they were like, no, it's the middle of school year. You stay here with us. And these people took care of me for the next year or so until I finished high school. Their son, their best friend, you know, at the end of our junior year, he said, why do your parents drink so much? And his parents were, you know, war babies, so they kept all the glassware, you know, the old mayonnaise jar, the old, you know, the jelly jars. I call it Irish crystal. They kept that around the house. And we took a mayonnaise jar and hit the liquor cabinets. His parents had full liquor cabinet, never touched it, except for hot toddies at Christmas. I don't know what a hot toddy is to this day, but we hit this liquor cabinet, and we filled it up, you know, that sneaky thing. We pulled a little of the vodka in, the little rum, the tequila, all the clear booze, and it didn't look right. Then we poured in the scotch, and we poured in whiskey, and this stuff didn't really look right at all. And then we poured in cream de mint, and then this stuff looked like gasoline. Yes, I drank alcohol for its effect, not for the taste. And we brought it to school. It sat in my locker in Central California at the end of May. It was about 95 degrees. It was in my locker for 3 hours. We went on a football field, a bunch of 15 and 16 years old, and we passed this gasoline around. I took a big slug. It went down my windpipe. It stung. It hurt. It burned. The next guy took a swig. It came back to me. I took another big guzzle, and all of a sudden, all that anger, all that fear, all that terror, all that hate, all that pain, all that frustration was suddenly gone. That gigantic hole that was my chest was gone, and it was just because of a couple of drinks. I was transformed. I was suddenly handsome like Cary Grant. I was funny like Rodney Dangerfield, and I was tough like Mike Tyson. Before that, I looked like Rodney Dangerfield. I was tough like Cary Grant, and I was funny like Mike Tyson. It was all backwards. Booze fixed that, and I loved it. And I could talk to the pretty girl. I could talk to anybody. My IQ on 40 points. I could talk to the toughest guys on the football team and the wrestlers. And that lasted a little while, because the next morning I woke up, I was sick to my stomach, and I didn't know how I got home, and I wet the bed. And I had a bad habit of taking things that did not belong to me when I drank, especially cars and women and money and things. I took these people who put me up, I took their car, and I went on a joyride, and I ran into get some gas pumps at a local gas station, and they asked me to leave. I came back to New York. I lived with my sister for a week. I had got a job in a restaurant as a busboy, and within a couple days, my sister said, I want you out of here, because suddenly I was ready for the races. I woke up one morning, I was 19 years old, had not a day gone by that I had not put a drink or something into my system. I wanted more. I wanted more of this. And sort of those things started to happen, you know, because we all put these conditions on our drinking. If I end up like this, like one guy in particular, if I end up like him, I would stop. This guy I used to work construction with, his name was Ray. We called him Bebo. If I end up like him, I'd stop drinking. If I got into a car accident, I'd stop drinking. If I lost a girlfriend, I'd stop. I lost a job, I'd stop. I'd spend all my money. If I got arrested, all those things started to happen very rapidly. And suddenly I was 19 years old. I was in my first institution. I was in 11, 12 HNIs. And every time I got to that point, I'm never going to do it again, I did it again, on and on and on and on again. To just give you one short story, I took a joyride in a car again, but this time I got stopped by the police. And there was a car. I had the keys to it. I wasn't supposed to be in a car. They arrested me. I was just really in bad shape physically. I was on everything you could possibly imagine, booze and all other dry goods. And they took me to central booking, and they processed me, and I stayed in there for a couple days, and they moved me to place for a couple days. And I was just kicking and screaming while I was in these jail cells, and total agony. And finally, they processed me, and I saw the judge, and they got me for, you know, unauthorized use or for stealing a car. And that's what I did. And I spent some time in Rikers Island. But when I was being processed, I was going through the whole thing. I met with a doctor, and he's sitting there looking at me, and he got everything about me. And when a doctor on Rikers Island says, you don't belong here, there's something really bad in your life. And he said, you don't belong here. And I didn't. And they put me in one of the big wings there, and I sat there, and I was just, even though I was dried out, the mental anguish of alcoholism, the depression, and all that pain was coming out. But I was on suicide watch for several weeks because they thought I was going to off myself. And someone sat at the foot of my bed with a flashlight every night. And eventually I got processed again, and they knocked down the charges to an unauthorized use of an automobile. And it gives you where my thinking was when they was standing in front of the judge. I chose to go back to Rikers Island because I had no place to go, and I had to wait 3 days to get my next welfare check. And I went back there. And I stayed there for 3 days. And eventually I got someone to bail me out for $1. And I got processed out. And after going through this anguish for about 3 weeks, I hit the streets, went to the check cashing place, got my money, and I went to the bodega around the corner and got a beer. And it's just, that's madness. That's insanity. I was bone dry. That's the definition of insanity. Several things I've done over my life, which was without drinking. Crazy things, falling down a stairwell on a construction site and leaving the hospital as a result of that because I wanted to drink. And because of that, I've had several surgeries throughout sobriety on my neck, shoulder, elbow, back. And it's just endless pain. And that wasn't the end of it. I did everything to stop drinking except to stop drinking. I thought maybe if I, you know, this would be different, this would stop. I got on a bus and went to California, and I was there in about 4 days. Mad as can be, and I was doing exactly what I was doing in New York, in California again. And I went to live with my mother and stepfather again. And these were the people who I hated most in the world, and they put me up. And I managed to get arrested there. I got into a detox, an outpatient program. And I stayed sober in a seat of my pants for 70 days. And I was building a deck for them one day. And my stepfather came out with a can of Old Milwaukee beer. And it was condensating in the sun. And he said, your problem is the drugs, not the booze. If you can learn to control your drinking, you'd be okay, just like me. And that made perfect sense. And I had one sip of that can of beer, and it was like I had never stopped because all I could think about was the next one coming from. I didn't drink the rest of that day. I didn't drink the following day. 2 days later, he offered to buy me a 12-pack. And I drank the 12-pack. I helped him drink his vodka. I prayed that he would pass out and go to sleep. He did. I went through his pockets, took his money, stole his car, drove into some town I'd never been before, and I found two people just like me. And I found more and more. And the next day, he realized what I did. He asked me to leave. He gave me money. And I came back here to New York. I couldn't go to Staten Island because there was a bunch of nine steps waiting for me there. And I was living on the streets of Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, and Sunset Park. I weighed about 180 pounds. I weigh about 215 right now. The only thing that mattered was where the next one was coming from. I didn't matter how I got it. Thank you. And I would kill or hurt anybody to get what I wanted. It didn't really matter. And, every night I passed out, I hoped this God that I did not believe in would kill me in my sleep. I just wanted the madness to end. And God heard that prayer because through daily dying, that person was killed to bring you the person who stands in front of you today. And I tried AA, it didn't work for me. And I'd go into detox and rehab and come out and hit the streets and I'd be left with me. One day I went to this church, and the church ladies were always good for $5 or $10, and one of them gave me her card. She invited me to her home, and I only went there to get a couple bucks and, steal something just so I can get more. And there at the kitchen table was her brother Richard, who had been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 16 years. He had crystal blue, clear blue eyes and a big smile on his face. And I tried to run one of my cons on him, and he pretty much told me, he's heard all the stories before, forget it, because he's used them all before. And he told me one thing that that penetrated this soul. He said, "You don't have to drink today." I don't have to drink today. And he took me to Graymore the next day with somebody else, and I stayed there overnight at the St. Christopher Inn, and they wouldn't keep me because they were afraid I was going to have a seizure and die. So I came back on one of the buses, and I called this guy Richard. And he picked me up. I called him. I was like, "I'll go to a meeting with you." And he picked me up with three other guys. And here I'm in the back seat of a car. Richard's driving. Guy in the front seat. Guy here. Guy here. And they were so happy to be going to an AA meeting. I hated them. I wanted out of that car. And it got to the meeting about an hour before the meeting. And I'm like, "What are we here for?" And they were like, "We're here to do ABCs, ashtrays, brooms, and chairs." And I'm like, "What?" And they set up the chairs, and I'm like, "What am I supposed to do?" And I'm like, "Here's the ashtrays. Put them on every other seat, except for those eight seats over there. That's a non-smoking section. Don't put them over there, whatever you do." I sat in the back, and one of the guys said, "Come up here, sit in front with me. You don't know anything about staying sober. Take the cotton out of your stick it in your mouth." And I was like, "Whoa, these guys are too drastic." And all I did was stew in this meeting. And then the next meeting was going to start. And I found the sucker in a meeting who was going to give me a couple bucks. And I asked the guy for money. He's like, "What do you want it for?" And I was like, "Pizza." And he was like, "Wait one second." So I waited for this guy patiently. And after the meeting, him and about a dozen other people took me to a diner, one of those big Brooklyn diners with a circular booth. And I was in the middle. I was the lab project keeping everyone sober, listening to me doing my bobble, they were doing their bobblehead thing as I was talking. And I told them I needed a job, I need my family back. And then someone said, "No, what you need to learn how to do is to stay away from the first drink." And these guys took me to meetings, they took care of me. I had a seizure outside of meeting, and someone who arranged for me to go into an outpatient or detox into a rehab out in Staten Island, the last place I wanted to be. And I got kicked out of there a couple days early, and I went downstairs. I was being brought down by a counselor. And she said to me, "There's an AA meeting starting across the hall. Why don't you go in?" And so I went into the meeting. It was a big meeting with Pilliards. It wasn't actually a big meeting. It was probably like 40 people. And I hid in the back. And remember the guy I mentioned with the Bebo? He was in the meeting. And they introduced him, and he was the speaker. So here's one of my measuring sticks, now sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the first time in my life, I put my hand up and I said, "I needed help." And people came over and they gave me the cards and they gave me, nobody gave me money. And they took care of me and they looked out for me. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me over the years. And I have to do back for Alcoholics Anonymous is constantly give back to you this magnificent gift. Not everything is perfect in Alcoholics Anonymous. As I said, I've had a lot of surgeries and a lot of physical pain over the years. I've spent half my sobriety in physical therapy and acupuncture. Thank you. When I was counting days, I got diagnosed HIV positive, and I thought it was a punishment from God. As someone told me, it wasn't. It was just the result of your careless living. And here I've been on protease inhibitors for over 20 years, and they can't die, they can't find it. It's undetectable. I still have it, just like I have alcoholism. But if I put these steps in front of my life, that's not a problem. The only problem is what lives in here, and I tell you about it, because this thing will continue to lie to me and tell me stories, and I just stay out of the way. I went to art school in early. People asked me what I wanted to do, and I started doing things at meetings, and they were like, "You should go to art school for that." I did, and I went to art school. I hated it, and I told my sponsor, and he told me, "Once you put to use what you learned in AA in art school, come early, stay late, sit in the front, put your hand up, do the required reading, do the homework, exchange numbers with your fellow students." I did. 4 years later, I graduated at the top of my class without saying an honors. And thank you. And, you know, I was recruited to get hired in this company in the early days of the internet. And I've been doing that type of stuff for the last over 20 years. And, you know, I go into buildings. I don't know how. If they only knew my real background, they wouldn't even probably let me in. But they do. And they actually look forward for me to do things. I get to do things that I never thought were possible. I've gone to places, you know, Africa several times, and I got to sit and read letters in the big book by a watering hole filled with elephants and giraffes and leopards and see these things, these things of beauties. Some of you in here wrote letters to me. Thank you. And I get to read and bring the message to you. When I was work construction, all these Norwegian guys used to ask me where your spirit was because I didn't feel like working. Well, I found my spirit, and it's here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you all for listening.